ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our special guest is Max Zilliman, Executive Director at Ulysses, a famous writing tool, and we're going to talk about product versions. This episode is brought to you by Nusi, proposal software made easy for creatives. Do you get stressed every time a new lead hits your inbox? Nusi was built to help you create, send, track, and manage your proposals in one easy-to-use app. Forget about searching for your best content and following up with clients to sign on the dotted line. Visit nusi.com/UIBreakfast for a 30% discount on your first 3 months. Hey, Max.
Hi there.
Good to be talking to you.
Yeah, good to be on the show. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. So before we get started, can you give us a background what you did before Ulysses and how that got started?
Before Ulysses, I basically did nothing. I was still in school when we started out.
I know. So, that's why I asked.
Yeah. It was on a mailing list. Like back then in 2002, when I got to know my partner, there were some forums, but most discussions were done via mailing lists. And he was posting a message looking for someone who was able to do a writing app. And I was the only one that replied. And so we got started and we're still there.
It's been some astronomical numbers of years ago that you've been out with Ulysses.
Right. It's 16 and a half years ago, I think.
How has your product vision evolved along the ways? Not just versions, but overall approach to building a product that serves to the masses.
It's completely different. So if you're a coding kiddie like me, 16 years old, you just do whatever you think is right, or you don't think what is right, you just do. And you end up in a very, very big mess. And then you rewrite everything and you end up in the same mess again. And then you learn that maybe rewriting, you should do something better. But yeah, everything has evolved massively over the years. We started out just the two of us and now we are a team of 18. A lot of coordination had to grow over the years. And we're doing many, many more things with the release nowadays than we did back then, for example.
Do you still feel like you're a product person or are you more of a manager these days?
I'm absolutely a product person, but I do have to do a lot of management. With a lot, I mean like maybe a third of my time or something, which is quite a lot for me. As a developer, I want to develop all day, but that doesn't work anymore.
Could you walk us through the milestones and the major versions that Ulysses has gone through from the very beginning? So, because we're talking about product versions today, and it's obvious that you've survived many of the rewrites and redesigns and relaunches.
So the original thing was just a quick idea, and we launched a 1.0 of the original Ulysses, and that got some traction, and we continued it as a hobby project for a couple of years, got a 1.1, 1.2, and so forth. In between, we did a rewrite, which turned out to not actually be a rewrite. Well, it was a rewrite, but we did all the same mistakes again. Then after 8 or so years, I finished university. So first I was in school, and then I went to university. And my partner, he's been a full-time web or advertisement designer. And When I finished university, there was this moment when the Mac App Store launched. So the App Store on the Mac came to the Mac, was on iOS before a couple of years. But when it came to the Mac, we put our old side project Ulysses on there. And in the first week, we got featured and we got like 20,000 euros in revenue just this 1 week. And we thought, damn, that's some money. We can both buy new Macs. And we can pay our rent and living for at least 3 months. We don't need much. If we don't give it a try now, we'll regret it later. So, and then I stopped my PhD that I just started. And Marcus, I don't think he actually quit his job. I think he was unemployed just at that very moment. So it was a good coincidence. And then we made it into a business. And this is when we decided to rewrite Ulysses again. And that was a tough one, but it came out 3 years later in 2014. anyway, and from then on, we added more people to the team, and we released a couple of versions. And 2 years ago, we switched to subscription business model, which has been a big transition as well. And we changed our release model with that as well.
Has your product vision itself evolved with all these redesigns and updates, or have you stuck to a single vision but different kinds of execution?
The vision has evolved, but the inner motivation that basically founds the vision is still the same. So when we started out, Marco's idea was to make an app for novel writers and make it as pleasant as possible to write in it and to allow to focus on the writing and not be distracted. And all those ideas are still very valid today. So we still have those core values. We still try to make it as pleasant to use. But of course, things have changed. So nowadays, there's mobile phones. Nowadays, there's well-known markup languages like Markdown. And so we, of course, had to adopt. And nowadays, another core vision is that it syncs between all your devices. And when we started out, there was no such thing as sync.
There is an interesting story about Markdown and your app, because they didn't quite appear at the same time, but sort of did, or something like that.
So the original Ulysses came out in July 2003. And the very popular markup language Markdown by John Gruber came out just 2 or 3 months earlier. So it was an interesting time where a lot of new markup languages were invented. For example, Textile, if you know it, it's a different markup language. It's around from the same time. So there was an era where people would come up with new markup languages. So the original Ulysses had its own markup language. It was in the same spirit as the original Markdown, and it sort of got created at the same point in time, but it had a different approach. And now that Markdown has established itself as like the predominant markup language everywhere, Ulysses also does Markdown, of course. But for almost a decade, it didn't do that.
You've been featured, and I think you've won some design awards with Ulysses. What do you think made it successful? Are there any specific features that you could highlight?
There are some features that are very important and critical to the product success, especially if you look at the history. There's a few milestones where it made a big jump forward. So, for example, bringing it from the Mac to the iPad was a big jump for us, and bringing it from the iPad to the iPhone was a big jump for us. Or, for example, making it possible to directly publish to WordPress was a big jump. But overall, I would say the success comes from persistence, continued development, great attention to detail, and all those things. So the core marketing aspect of the entire app is its quality and its design. And this is something you can't do overnight. So you need to grow it. You need to constantly work on it. You need to keep the product always up to date and always in close sync with the platform that it's on, that on every device that it runs on. It has the optimal user experience. And if you continue that for quite a while and you really persist doing this, people will start using it and will start loving it. And once they love your product, they will tell others about it. And this is the number one source of growth, I would say, still nowadays, that we have is word of mouth propagation. But that is a really, really long ramp. Course. Now we are 16 years in, so the ramp has gotten us somewhere. But initially, and even in the middle, it felt like really long ramp, though very satisfying, because everybody that comes, or a lot of people that come and discover Ulysses, come because they got it recommended by a friend, which is usually a very good outset.
How does the launch cycle, the release cycle look for you these days? Because you do run a desktop app and you deal with the multiple app stores. So you've got to be super disciplined. And we are hoping to learn a lot from you today about that. So tell us and give us an overview how that works in general.
When you just think about releasing an app, it would come naturally that would say, well, you do the programming and then you release it. And what is there else, right? That's all that needs to be done. But nowadays, we have a lot of things that we do. We do for example, personal press outreach. We have a press release with every single release. We localize into all the languages that we have. We pre-announce new releases to multiple places, for example, to press outlets at least a week before, and to Apple as the platform provider at least a month before. We need to organize all the localizations that we do for all those communications in advance with the localization agency. So we need to negotiate dates with them and make sure that we hit those dates. And overall, the whole process and everything that we do, all the blog posts, all the newsletters, everything is a process that takes basically 8 people for 1.5 to 3 months and almost 200 to-do items to get that done.
When it comes to managing those international versions, let's talk about that a little bit. How long into the journey of your product have you decided to expand into markets? And were there any breakthrough countries that were major for your business growth?
We started fairly early, I would say. You know, English natives, you might have heard that. So with Germans, and we did build the app initially in English, but we also made a German version from early on. So we always had at least 2 languages. And then if you're running a small indie business or do a small indie app back in the early 2000s on the Mac platform, some user would come and say, hey, you know, I speak French. Shouldn't I translate your app into French? And you would say, hey, that sounds cool. Let's do it, of course. And then you have a French localization, which doesn't mean that you understand any French, but it means that you'll get French emails from French people asking questions in French that you can't answer. And the next issue that comes up is as soon as you add a new feature that is not already localized into French, so you need to find that person again and convince them to update the localization to French. And as it turns out, the person doing the first localization usually just wanted that free license that they got in exchange, and they never really rarely replied back with the upgraded translations. So what you would have to do is you would either kill the localization, which is kind of sad because you have it already, or you release it with an incomplete localization. So you have a French version and some parts of the interface are still English. And then somebody using it in French would notice and be annoyed by it and contact you, hey, shouldn't I update your localization? And
in French.
In French, yeah, right, exactly. but it's a really involved process, and you basically never, ever have localizations that are up to date, and it's a lot of work.
You dropped the word agency that is involved these days.
Right, right, exactly.
That's where we're going.
You get why, because we tell them, hey, you know, this is the amount of text that we have. This is the date that we deliver it to you, and this is the day that we want it back. Of course, we know how long it takes them. It roughly takes them a week for any amount of text that we give them, usually. So we know we can roughly plan that ahead, but then we negotiate those dates, and then we can plan exactly. We know that we'll get all the languages that we need, and that we'll get it complete, and that we'll get it all back on time. And in terms of languages that were a game changer, I can really just say that for recent editions, because those old editions are so long ago that I don't remember really. But one of the recent editions that we've done that it's been really massive to us was China, or Chinese localization. We didn't have a Chinese localization, and I think it was Marcus that said, you know, there's a lot of iPhone and Mac users in China. Shouldn't we just try and make a Chinese localization and see what happens? Because China was very far low on the list of our markets, I think roughly spot 30 or 40 or something. So not really important, 40th most important country. So we did a localization, and initially nothing happened. But then over the course of 2 years, again, with persistence and continued work on the localization and improvements that we made to it, it gained traction. And China became the number 2 market for us for at least a couple of years. It's in the top 5 still today. China really, really has been an important growth factor for us due to the localization. It wouldn't have happened without any localization, and then some.
What do you do with that support volume that comes in multiple languages?
We mentioned that our support is English only, I think, somewhere. And then we happen to have a few team members that speak a few languages. So, for example, nowadays we can reply in French, I think, and we can understand.
Finally.
Yeah. And we have a dedicated person to care about the Chinese market, which is the other aspect of going to China, is that you can't just repeat what you've done in the Western market, but you need to be different. And she can answer Chinese requests. And yeah, and otherwise we just have a nice sentence that was also translated by a professional that says, hey, we're very happy that you wrote an email to us, but we don't speak your language. We've put it into Google Translate and now we're writing you an English answer.
We have an episode here in the show about international UX, and there our listeners can dive into more details like why localization is not just translation. You have to really adopt the landing pages, the approach, and many, many other things. So having a team member in your team or somewhere on the site locally really, really helps. It's not as easy as it sounds.
One thing that has really been an insight for me was realizing that China, as much as other countries, for example, Russia, I think is similar, is really not separated from the rest of the world, but they have their own ecosystem. For example, in China, there are some people using Twitter and Facebook, but most people, basically everybody, is on Weibo. So if you're a product and you want to be successful in China, you should have a Weibo account. And you have someone that knows how Weibo works, which is not the same as Twitter or Facebook. And you need someone to be able to reply to messages and so on and so forth. So it's not just having an agency translate some text. You really need to work on it. And I think that's something that's possible now for us as we've grown, but it wouldn't have been possible from day one. So it's definitely something to look into if you've grown and want to expand to China.
If you take localizations aside, what would be a brief checklist of the assets that you prepare for each of your releases?
It's a long list. So
it's not a brief list. I just realized it's probably like 50 items long.
I can put it a bit shorter. So the first thing we do with a release is we give it a theme. So we usually try to, when I say release, I mean we release a few major features, which is not continuous, but at some points in the year, we have like 3 or 4 releases every year. So when we do a release, we have a set of features that's going to go out. And the first thing we do is we give it a visual theme. So every release, for example, has for promotional images, different backgrounds, but that are slightly different for every image that we send out, but are consistent within the release. So one release might get green with, I don't know, flowers, just as an example, but you get the idea. And the other is blue with whales or something. And then from that, we develop promotional images that we use in multiple ways. We write a press release, which is, if you don't know what a press release is a very special kind of text that basically is there for journalists to copy and paste from. So what you do is you write a text about what you published in the third person, so that someone that writes an article about you has something where they can take snippets from or get inspiration. And we fill it with the promotional images that we do. And this press release then gets translated into all the languages that we have, which is sort of the point of a press release. If the point of a press release is to make it as easy as possible to copy from, you don't want journalists to have to translate the text from your text, but provide it in their natural language. And the press release then goes into a press kit. And the press kit is full of those promotional images. It's full of screenshots. It's mood images. It has the current application description, the pricing model, everything that you would need to have if you would write your first article about our product. So make it as easy as possible to know everything that's relevant to be able to publish about it. And then this press release with the press kit is sent out to personal press contacts and the press mailing list. So we have a couple of hundred people that we email personally and that we have a relationship with, which takes time to build and energy to maintain, of course. And then for that's basically the promotional, the press part, press. And then we have a newsletter that we send out on every release, but additional newsletters that go out before and after the release. And before the release, the newsletters from time to time depends on the release and what we do. But often enough, we have preview blog posts where we talk about things that will be coming. And those blog posts, for example, also use those promotional images, which is, we're not going into too much detail because things may change still, but we are communicating to our users what we're working on and that we're working on something, that we're not just chilling. And after a release, we do tutorials. So we introduce in detail and exactly how to do all those new features and what's important about them. And we have blog posts covering everything that's new and that's changed. And those also use screenshots and promotional images and go into newsletters. And then we have support documents where we have technical explanations of certain aspects. For example, when we integrated WordPress publishing, you don't want to know how many broken configurations of WordPress are out there. And someone had to write support documents for all those cases that would come up during the beta test. And we need to have this prepared. We need to prepare the support team to know about all those cases and to know how to detect them and how to reply. Basically, we also have to get the support team up to speed with the new release so that when a user installs it and has a question, that they're able to answer. And that also has to happen, of course, before the release.
I'm so happy that we're talking about all this infrastructure now, because if you watch like social media and stuff, you get an impression that the major product work happens when, you know, you do user research, you decide what to build, you build it and you launch it. Like that's how products work. But from what you're saying, it becomes obvious that no success can be achieved without all these supporting documents, infrastructure, and very hard work.
Yes, and what I would say, what is really, really important is that you need to communicate about what you're doing to your users, especially if you're in a SaaS business or in a subscription business like we are. Users want to see and perceive the continuous value that you provide. Of course, you provide the product and they know that, but then they always want this little extra. They want to know that you're working on it and that you're working on it in their favor. That you're not working on it for somebody else, but for everybody. And so it's very important to communicate about what you're doing. And at some points when you're, for example, removing features, why you're doing that, and it should just be open and approachable. It's very important.
Have you removed features a lot?
No. And we have removed features and reintroduced them. So it's not an easy thing to do, but we did remove features, and there's a few minor features on our list that that we hope we'll get rid of, but not today.
You mentioned relationships with journalists that you've been nurturing over years, and thank you so much for giving the details what goes into the press kit and everything. By the way, could you probably link maybe to a sample press release or press kit that our listeners can take a look at?
Yeah, I think it's on ulysses.app/presskit.
Awesome, we're going to link to that. And speaking of journalists, of course, now that you're super famous and you have 200 people on your list, that's easy to say, but how did it all start? How did you nurture your first few relationships?
My partner did just look at blogs they would read and search for blogs they would find interesting, and then try to find out a direct email address to somebody at that blog. And most publications have an email address where you can post messages to. And what you do is you start reaching out. You say, hey, I've read your blog and I think you would be interested in my product, which is cool because of this and that. If you're interested, please get back and I'll give you a tour or something. And that is really some really very basic outreach initially. But then those people start to write about you, and then maybe they write about you again. And so you start to build a relationship over years. Yeah.
Do you think that part of your public relations work accounts for a large part of your success with the product?
I have no metric on this, to be honest. Of course, it has a role and it's an important aspect, but I don't know if it's the most important aspect, for example, or if word of mouth might be the important, most important aspect. Or if our own newsletter that has over 100,000 subscribers nowadays is maybe not just the most important aspect. Or, and here comes another aspect, we're in Apple's golden cage, the App Store, and getting featured by Apple is definitely a very important aspect. I couldn't say if it's the most important aspect, but of course we do work to be in a situation where Apple can feature us. So we try to always be up to date with the platforms, be up to date with the devices, ship current features of the OSs, and then Apple will include you in lists of, for example, apps optimized for iOS 13, which is the current release. And that, of course, is visibility, and that, of course, is an important way to gain new users. But all those aspects, they're somehow interlinked, and so it's difficult to say which one is the most influential. But we do them all because we believe in each of them to be influential.
I know that Ulysses is a desktop app, and you obviously, that's a very conscious choice because you take pride in small interactions and other things that wouldn't be possible within a web application. But if that wasn't the case and you had a choice whether to run it as a web app or as a desktop app, would you enjoy, you know, that releaseless, continuous improvement that web application people can do? Or would you prefer these, you know, publicity splashes like you do with the releases?
I think there's two sides of the medal. So, of course, I would like to get rid of the approval process by Apple and be able to push new updates every single day, for example, or every week or so, as many SaaS products do. But then, on the other side, for us, quality is really, really crucial. So you can't just push out anything. You always need to check again, and you need to make sure that it is within the quality requirements. And so what we have is we have a process that where we check everything before it goes out manually and automatically, and also think it through again and even months before we release it. And that process is sort of induced by the app review process and the way the app is installed. But because once it's installed on the device, you can't remove it, you can't update it until the user updates it themselves. So if you have something that's broken, it's broken for them for maybe a day or a week or a month or something. So you really need to make sure that you're not breaking anything. This process of quality assurance and of releasing only a few times a year a big chunk of features has its upsides, because it's induced by the app review and the desktop app thing, but it helps you focus, it helps you build a narrative. If you just release one feature, maybe nobody's interested, but if you release two or three features together, then maybe that's worth talking about. It's really a balance between the two that I would prefer.
Speaking of app stores, how do you go about launching around holidays? Do you never do that, or would you rather do this for some reasons?
We try to avoid it, because launching on holidays means that journalists have a hard time. So launching on holidays is basically just about the journalism, I would say, and for our customer support. So for our customer support, it's important to be available around releases before to get the training, and after, much more available to be able to answer replies, answer questions. And so for there, it's good to not be on holidays. And then for the press, it's important because the press always wants to be up to date. So if you announce in a release and say it's coming on a certain date, then the journalist will write the article maybe the day before or on that date. And usually, as we all do. And if that's a holiday, they have a hard time getting it out on that day. And if they publish it only a day later, then it's not the most up-to-date news they can deliver. And then they might even skip it. So launching on holidays is a bit difficult. I wouldn't recommend it.
Speaking of deadlines, how do you manage to stick to your deadlines? Because I believe with so many people in charge, then you really have to stick to the promised deadlines.
There is this image of a product process where you can imagine your product as a progress and you have to go across a hill. So as long as you go up, you don't know how long it's going to take. But as soon as you're on the downside of the hill, you know how high the hill was and you know how far it takes you to get down. And we only ever schedule releases when we're on the downside of the hill. So there is some certainty to it. We have absolutely no release deadlines or schedules or plans other than maybe a month target before we are on this downhill slope. And then we only set a date for a release and a deadline, I should say, when we're fairly certain, but we're not most of the time, when we're relatively certain that we're almost done. And then we have like a 6 to 8 week ahead of the final release date set. And then we work back with the schedule from there. Since we've been through this release process very, very many times now, and especially also this complicated release process that we have nowadays, since we formalize it, we have a project planning tool where all the to-dos are inside and where we know the dependencies. So then we know how long things take and where things went wrong before. And whenever something went wrong in the release, we add a new to-do inside the plan to make sure that the next time this is not happening, or we change the dates, or we say, this needs at least two days apart, getting the release, the translated text and sending out the press email, for example, needs to be 2 days apart and not just 1 day, because maybe the thing comes back on the evening and you need to send it out in the morning. So all those things we've worked into our plan, and we know how long those things usually take because most of them are repetitive. Writing a press release doesn't take between 2 months and a day. It usually takes 2 or 3 days to get it finished. So we know how long those things take. And if you add some extra time before and after everything and you stretch it out a bit, then you can be pretty sure that this works out. But you need to do it first and you need to fail first. And then as you do it a couple of times, you learn and you optimize your planning and your schedule.
What are the key mistakes that you would recommend our users to strongly avoid when planning for like feature releases and something like that?
There's a few things that have gone wrong. One thing is to announce something to the press to go out on a certain day and then not releasing on that day. For whatever reason, you should definitely be reaching out at least a day before a canceled release and make sure everybody knows that it's canceled. We've had blog posts about releases going up for releases that wouldn't come for weeks. And someone had a review of the new version up there, and people would ask us, where is this release? Where can I try it out? And that's maybe not optimal. Basically, what I would say is make building expectations that you can't be certain you can fulfill. I mean, you can never be very, very absolutely certain, but you can be fairly certain. And for example, you shouldn't announce features that you didn't even start building. That's something we've done. We only shipped that particular feature, I think, 3 years later. And we got a lot of questions about this feature and all those kinds of mistakes that happen when you try to satisfy demands and people come and ask questions and you reply too openly about them. Then you build expectations, and those expectations can often just go wrong. And then people are sad about it, although you could have also been honest and they wouldn't be sad.
Yeah, that thing we really, really have been improving on that skill, for example, at UserList over the last year, because you want to be super positive and optimistic to your customers. So you disclose more about your plans than you should, just like you said, and then it leads to false expectations, which is not great.
Exactly. And it's better to be honest and to say we don't have the capacity to build that right now, or it's something that we wish for, but that's not coming in the foreseeable future. So everybody knows what to expect, and that's a strong recommendation from my side.
One more small question. Do you have a public roadmap or do you not?
We don't. exactly the same reason. If you put something on there and you don't work on it, that's difficult because people will come and ask, when does this ship? You said it here, you would be working on it. You said it would be shipping last March on the roadmap, and now it's the end of 2019 and it's still not here. You're liars. that's what you hear. Yeah, unfortunately.
Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom today, Max. I'm hoping this was useful for our listeners. Where can people find you and Ulysses online?
You can find me on Twitter. I'm at MacGuru17. Don't judge that name, please. you can always email me. It's max@ulysses.app. And you can find my product on ulysses.app, the website.
Fantastic. Thanks so much once again. And I hope you have a great rest of your week.
Thank you very much for having me. Bye-bye.